Right, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's Saturday this afternoon. You've been dancing with cold water, so I hope you've got a little energy left. And we're starting with the island of Sicily. And you can see that it is very, very close to the mainland. That is the toe of Italy just popping in there. And that, of course, is the Straits of Messina. The symbol and flag of Sicily is here on the bottom left. It's this lady with the three legs, the tricarnia, which are the three corners of the island. It's a three-cornered island. The Trinacria was the ancient name of Sicily, but the ancient tribes, who you see here, are very shadowy. We don't really know much about them, little archaeological discoveries. They were there long before the civilizations which we shall discuss occurred. They would have been there 10,000 BC or so. They came probably from the mainland, and they would have been absorbed by the later settlers. But the one interesting thing is that the Elymians, we'll see very briefly later on, there was the Sicani and then the Sicels. And the Sicels give their name to Sicilia, which is Sicily. So that is the word, origin of the word. But as I say, the ancient name of the island was the three-cornered island, the Trinacria, with this lady with the three legs. The first great moment when Sicily comes into focus, and why, is that Sicily is always, still is, enormously fertile, enormously productive. It is volcanic, of course, so there's very good soil, and it has plentiful rainfall in the winters, and a terribly hot summer, but it is a very successfully productive island. So by 734 BC, from the east, from Greece, came settlers. Now, of course, you know that ancient Greece was not a country, it was a separate series of city-states, always at loggerheads with each other. So therefore, the peoples came from various cities, from Chalcis, from Corinth, from Rhodes, from Crete, and so on. And they came and settled on the coastline, finding a convenient port, finding a hinterland which would be productive, because what they were there for was to produce, in a much more fertile environment than Greece, produce principally grain. Grain has been the export of Sicily for thousands of years. So then they settle on the eastern coastline and the southern coastline, and then form sub-colonies. The city of Gela, which actually hardly has any remains today, then forms a sub-colony in Agrigento. Similarly, Syracuse forms a sub-colony. So by about 650 BC, there will be about 50 settlements around the coast, not on the western side. The western side was always occupied by the Carthaginians. The Carthaginians who came from Tunisia, now modern Tunisia, who were originally Phoenicians from the Levant, and it is this coastline that they occupy up until the Romans. So it's really the Greeks that we're now discussing. This amazing arrival of the Greeks who, by, as I say, the 500s, become established, rich, powerful cities. The most powerful, the richest Greek city was always Syracuse. And a lot of the people one thinks of in ancient history, a lot of the great names of Greek history, are actually associated with Sicily. Aeschylus is the best first example. Aeschylus, the father of tragedy, of course. He was Athenian. He writes between 70 and 90 plays, of which seven survive. And two of his plays, we know, are performed in the theatre of Syracuse. Now, the theatre didn't look like this. We shall see how it developed later. But it was, by the time his play, The Persians, was performed in 472, it was actually performed in the theatre in Syracuse. And Aeschylus goes at least once, if not twice, to Sicily, and actually dies in Gela, the town on the south coast. In fact, the stories tell one, the legends tell us, that he died by having a tortoise dropped on his head by an eagle, which seems about as far-fetched as you can go, really, but anyway, it is because now, the name, I bet you, well, perhaps you do know, you're all frightfully clever, but I never knew that Archimedes came from Sicily. When Archimedes jumps out of the bath and goes down the street in the nude, shouting Eureka, I always thought that was in Athens, but it wasn't. It was in Syracuse. Archimedes was born in Syracuse and dies in Syracuse. He is, of course, the most approachable of all these ancient names. He's so sort of meaningful even today. That's a rather lovely imaginary portrait of him, by the way. And that is that was his eureka moment, where he discovered that the body must displace its own bulk when immersed. So he jumps into the bath, the water all splashes out, and bam, he's discovered the Archimedes principle. Even the other day, there was some reference to some, I don't know where now, in Africa, and they were using the Archimedes screw. Still 500 years on, we are still using his means of bringing water up from a lower level to a higher level. He dies in 212. In Syracuse, he dies during the Roman invasion, he dies when a Roman soldier approaches him, and he says, "Don't disturb my circles," which is really, "Don't disturb my thoughts" or whatever. And that is obviously a legend perpetuated, because that is a Roman mosaic floor, probably 400 or 500 years later, or about 400 years later, showing this very incident. So Archimedes obviously is the greatest citizen of Syracuse, and Syracuse is the greatest city of the ancient Sicily. Legends also are associated with Sicily, the Greek legends. The one which is particularly significant is Persephone. Persephone, who in Latin is Proserpina. Persephone, often Sicily is referred to as Persephone's island. Persephone, who was the daughter of Zeus and Demeter, and she is the goddess of the corn, which of course is the product which Sicily is famous for. And supposedly, while she was picking flowers, now this wonderful mosaic, wonderful fresco, that comes from an area near Pompeii, which of course was covered by the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD. It's a fragment. We don't know what the story was, but it could be Persephone, because while she was picking flowers in the meadows of Enna, Enna is right in the middle of Sicily, rather like the hole in the middle of a disc, and she's picking flowers in the meadow, having a lovely time when, whoops, the god of the underworld comes and sweeps her up and drags her down to hell. And there is the god of the underworld, who in Greek is Hades and in Latin is Pluto. The famous statue there by Bernini is reflecting that very event which took place in Sicily. Now, similarly here, the god of the winds, Aeolus, comes from Sicily. And the Aeolian Islands, that wonderful series of superbly pretty islands, north, that is the northern coast of Sicily there. The Aeolian Islands are the habitat of the god of the winds. Homer writes about the god of the winds in the Aeolian Islands, and he gives the winds to Odysseus. Odysseus has the bad winds tied up in a bag, but then, of course, the sailors want to see what's in the bag, and they unloose the winds, and that's why we have the southeaster in Cape Town. Virgil writes that Aeolus, and this lovely, lovely illustration, of course, is absolutely minute, the size of a postage stamp. It is from a miniature, it's a miniature of a choral missile in the Piccolomini Library in Siena. Virgil says that Aeolus either lived in Lipari or in Stromboli. Anyway, you now know that where our winds come from. And then the famous phrase, it was used only the other week, you probably read it like I did, in The Spectator, somebody was referring to something as being between Scylla and Charybdis, between the devil and the deep blue sea, between the rock and a hard place. Scylla was on the Italian side, Charybdis was on the Sicilian side, and they were at the very narrow point between the toe of Italy and the top of northern Italy, Sicily, where, of course, when the storms are great, it does become a raging, tumultuous sort of whirlpool. And it is dangerous. But of course, the ancients thought they were monsters that ate sailors and dragged ships down. This is a wonderful illustration, a cartoon by Gilray, the English cartoonist, 1793. That is the Prime Minister of the time, William Pitt, with Britannia on the boat called the Constitution. And those are the other parliamentarians swimming behind him. And there he's sailing between Scylla and Charybdis, leading Britain, of course, to the peace and tranquility of that island beyond. Now, of course, the recent shipwreck in Italy didn't take place, but it wasn't the fault of Scylla and Charybdis, because it was further north, but it was the ship that the captain should surely have been captured by one of them and drowned. But anyway, that's another story. Now, Arethusa is very particular to Sicily, because legend which is associated with Syracuse. Now, Arethusa was a sea nymph, was a water nymph, and she goes swimming, well, rather foolishly, really. She swims in the nude. So then she attracts the attentions of Alpheus, who's a god of the river. She tries to escape, calls to Artemis, who is the goddess Diana, the goddess of virginity, and then Artemis changes her into a river, and she flows under the world and comes up in Syracuse. So there is a pond, it's called the Fountain of Syracuse, it's fresh water, and that where those figures are, they're looking onto the Mediterranean. So there's a freshwater pond with bulrushes or there are ducks floating, and by the way, that's a fig tree, and one of the earliest examples of the fertility of Sicily is that the fig tree is not actually indigenous to Sicily itself. Obviously came from the Middle East. I mean, Eve's wardrobe wouldn't be anything without it. But the fig tree is a very early import into Sicily. And again, the guides today, which is a lot of nonsense really, but the guides say, the Greeks call Sicily a land of figs and almonds, rather like a land of milk and honey. Anyway, the Arethusa, that's a coin from the ancient Syracuse, a decagram, 400 BC, silver coin. There are lots of them, but it's one of the sort of coins that you yearn for if you are a numismatist. And that is showing Arethusa with her dolphins. Now, the ancient settlement of Syracuse was on an island. That's where the fountain of Arethusa is. It's the island of Ortigia, O-R-T-I-G-A, and that obviously for an island for protection. You can see it there from the aerial view. It's got just a little causeway that links it to the mainland of Syracuse. And even in the ancient times, the city obviously expanded. This is the ancient city with various suburbs in the 3200s BC. Again, you can see the island there with that big Norman castle at the edge, at the end. Now, Syracuse will be the main principal city of all those Greek settlements, and today, in the centre of the city, of course, is the cathedral. Now, the cathedral has this magnificent Baroque facade. A Sicilian Baroque is a particular style of the 18th century, and we'll see why later on. This magnificent sense of decoration and build-up from the sides to the centre, tremendously grand, but when you go round to the side, obviously we're looking at the west facade. If you go round to the side, you'll see a very different building. It is Greek columns of the 5th century BC, and it is Arab battlements of the 9th century or 10th century AD. I mean, that is a wonderful example of the layers and layers and layers of civilization who have left their mark on Sicily and, of course, contributed so enormously to the history and the fascination of the island. Now, this is the temple erected in 480 BC when the ruler of Sicily at the time led a force, including soldiers from other Greek cities, to defeat the Carthaginians. The fact is, they were both inhabiting the same island. They were obviously going to clash. And in 480 BC, Gelon, who's the tyrant or the leader, the dictator of Syracuse, leads a force which defeats the Carthaginians at the Battle of Hibera, and he then builds a temple. That temple still survives because it is the structure of the cathedral. I mean, it's unique in this world. Those Doric columns, 480 BC, are the same, the ones inside. Then, of course, that is the side aisle. And then if you go through the side aisle to the right of the screen, you come into the nave. Well, the nave actually is the inner sanctuary of a Greek temple. The arches have been placed in the Greek temple later, because we obviously want side aisles and the central nave. But those good little tourists there are all sitting actually in a Greek temple of 480 BC. And this wonderful overladen series of civilizations. And if you want your child christened in the Cathedral of Syracuse, he or she will be christened in a baptismal font, which is, in actual fact, it's up there on the left, a 5th century BC crater carved from Paros marble. So it is, as I say, again, this amazing, amazing series of civilizations that have come and gone in Sicily. Now, after the battle of 480, which was commemorated by the temple, which then becomes the cathedral, obviously it was only too evident to the later rulers of Syracuse, including this most famous of them, a man called Dionysius. Now, they are called tyrants. A tyrant is, to our mind, in our definition, a gruesome, ruthless, brutal, terrible creature. And a tyrant originally, of course it's a Greek word, the tyrant is, in fact, a beneficent ruler. He wasn't then, the words change meaning, in other words. However, Dionysius the Elder was a very far-sighted man. He realized that while they had defeated the Carthaginians, they were going to regroup and come back and fight again. So what he does is create this defensive wall all the way around Syracuse. We saw it stretching into the distance in that plan I showed you a few slides back. And he builds this enormous 27-kilometer wall round Syracuse. You can still see vestiges of it. This was obviously a fortress within the wall structure to protect the town. And it still sort of survives in these big, big blocks. It's been estimated that to build this wall of 27 kilometers with all these great towers and so on, it would have involved 300 tons of stone a day being laid for 5 years consecutively without a break at all. And it is amazing, the ingenuity and the ability to direct that. Now, the stone came from the quarries. On the mainland, if you go in from the island of Ortygia, which of course now is the old ancient city of Syracuse, where you'll choose to be if you stayed there. But if you go inland, you see these quarries, still part of Syracuse. You see these quarries. Now that was once solid stone. That's all being dug down by Dionysius and his slaves. Now, the thing that you're shown as a tourist is the ear of Dionysius. It's obviously a fissure in the rock, and the story is, though, that Dionysius would sit above and listen to the slaves whispering and plotting their attack and whatever, plotting their escape. Well, I mean, that's as far-fetched as you'll get, but it's a lovely touristy thing. But it does remind you of the extent and the amazing dynamism of this civilization, where they can build these walls, where they can dig these quarries out, where they can build these amazing temples at the drop of a hat, really. And it's the wealth they have. Now, again, the story of the sword of Damocles, we already use the phrase when some threat is hanging over us, comes from this very period in Syracuse. It's the Dionysius of Syracuse, we've just discussed, is this great figure. Now, this, of course, is an imaginary 19th century painting by an English artist, and if you want to see it, it's in America. The story is quite clearly portrayed there. Damocles is a young courtier who's endlessly moaning on about the fact that he envies his boss, Dionysius. So Dionysius eventually gets fed up with this, and he says, well, come and have a great feast. You'll sit at the head of the table and enjoy all the fruits that I enjoy as a ruler. But he sits at the head of the table with the sword suspended by one horse's hair. And, of course, he quickly gets up and decides he actually doesn't want to be a big ruler after all. And the sword of Damocles, the threat which we use. And that's all again from Sicily. Bet you didn't know that. And now, towards the end of Greek rule, is the last of the great rulers, Hieron. He calls himself a king, King Hieron the Second. That's him on a coin. And there's a brief moment of a sort of Indian summer of the Greek civilization in Sicily in the late 200s, just as you gained out of the 100s BC. Why? Because what is happening now, and Hieron realizes that there's a new kid on the block, Rome. Rome is progressively coming down the Italian peninsula, and Hieron realizes that he should be a supporter of Rome, and this gives him a peaceful reign. And during this reign, there is this amazing building period. It's during the reign of Hieron that the theater of Syracuse, as we see it today, is built. This enormous Greek theater, the largest Greek theater in existence. But it was, of course, a much smaller entity, as I said, when Aeschylus performed there. Now, he builds again everything bigger and better than before. He builds this altar where it's thought that 400 bulls at a time were slaughtered. Can you imagine the stench and the straw, the noise, and that must be terrible. Then eventually Hieron dies, and it eventually, inevitably, Rome captures Syracuse. It's a long 2-year siege, during which Archimedes invented the claw, these great sort of arms, have at their end a great sort of anchor thing that they drop onto a Roman ship. The anchor goes through the wooden ship and then upends it. And if you see that the upended ships there. It was often thought to be imaginary. This, of course, is a very modernish reconstruction. But it was thought to be imaginary, but recently an American university actually built one of these, and it actually did work. You will see there the upended ship. However, the Rome obviously is not going to be stopped, and then, as we saw, Archimedes actually is one of those who die when the Romans actually do invade and capture Syracuse. By which stage, you see, the battle is set. It's Rome against the Carthaginians. The Greeks are going to be knocked off, but the Rome, either one or the other, is going to dominate the Mediterranean, and the one who owns Sicily will dominate the Mediterranean because it's right in the middle. So obviously, as we know, Rome wins. Now, going on, we'll go back in time. Agrigento was a sub-colony of the town called Gela. Agrigento again became a very rich city during the Greek era and will fight with Gelon in the Battle of Himera. Agrigento, which again will now be destroyed by the Carthaginians. They will return, you see, and they'll do enormous destruction in revenge for their earlier defeat. And there is the famous series of temples in Agrigento. The old city was where all these trees are now. And for some reason, the temples were on the perimeter of the ancient city, and for some reason, the Carthaginians leave them intact, or virtually intact. The one on the left is the Temple of Hera, which is Juno in Latin. That is a 19th century painting of the same temples. And there you see the Temple of Concord. The Temple of Concord is amazing. It is almost as it was built 2,500 years ago. It wasn't destroyed by invasions. It wasn't destroyed by attack. It hasn't been damaged by earthquake. It's just somehow miraculous that it stands there now almost exactly as it was built by the Agrigentans at their height of their power and wealth. A perfect Doric example of a temple, the Doric columns, the Doric capitals, the Doric frieze there, that is, those are the triglyphs, the lines drawn along the frieze of the temple. And one of its saving graces was that in the Christian era, it was made into a church, which again preserved it from vandalism and so on. And so now it is an amazing example. All Greek temples, by the way, in Sicily, as well as on the southern part of Italy, are Doric. Then there are no later Ionic temples in Sicily. So they're all of this wonderful, early, balanced, calm, magnificently powerful form of building. You see it here in all its splendor, as I say. But what is most extraordinary is that a very completely ruined temple, thought to be a Bagan, again, like the cathedral, like the temple that's now the cathedral in Syracuse, thought to be a Bagan in 480 when the Agrigentans and the Syracusans win the Battle of Himera. They begin to build, never finish it, and then destruction occurs, most possibly earthquakes as well as man. And they were going to build the largest temple ever constructed, ever, anywhere, in the Greek civilization, or in the Roman civilization, for that matter. It was going to be enormous, so big, obviously, they probably even couldn't finish it. Those figures there, which are called telamones, we call them Atlantes, these large figures like Atlas supporting the world, you can see them there, you can see them in a mock-up in the museum. They are half the height from the steps to the beginning of the entablature. They're 26 feet in length. So that's 52 feet. It's the size of a sort of 4 or 5 story building today. Nothing survives really. That's a complete mock-up. All that does survive are fragments and big mounds of rubble. But the mounds of rubble are very interesting. Can you see there? There's grooves cut in the stone. There's some there as well. That is for the groove for the ropes to really put these great blocks of stone, probably weighing 30 tons or so, in position. And obviously they're put in position either by use of a crane, with humans, of course, inside, working the crane. Very good for the exercise, I think we should all do that a bit. And then otherwise, then again, they're pulled, obviously, from tripods to place of in position. Also, the column, of course, a Greek column is never one single piece of stone. They are drums, and each part is joined one to the other with metal fitments, as you can see there. Now, in 1972, there was a chap from Rome who was on his August holiday, and he was scuba diving in the area between the eastern coast of Sicily and the southern sort of instep of Italy. And as he was scuba diving, swimming around the fish and having a lovely time, he suddenly saw this body lying there. And he thought, oh my God, mafia, you know, what's going on? And it turned out to be these two statues. He fortunately was a very intelligent man and a very sensible man, and he went to alert the authorities, because if he had told his mates in the bar, nothing would have been left of it. The grave robbers would have come and they would have all been destroyed. So they do survive as the most famous Greek statues anywhere on earth, and they are amazingly fascinating, and because they were close to a town on the coast of the very bottom of Italy, they're called the Riace bronzes, and they are today displayed in a museum in a town, the major town of the area called Reggio Calabria. It's just across the water from Sicily. They're slightly different in date. That one is slightly later than the chap there. By the way, they're virtually complete. They have ivory in there, as if for their eyes. The iris would have been lapis lazuli. That chap's got metal teeth. And they are transitional. The weight is now the weight is on one leg, as opposed to the earlier archaic Greek statues, which are sort of frozen figures of no emotion at all. Here they're becoming human beings, and the next step will be the Parthenon and later statuary, which of course is very realistic and emotional and moving and so on. But they are amazing, and they would have probably almost undoubtedly have come from Sicilian temples, probably looted by some corrupt Roman governor or whatever, but we'll never know what really, but they are a miracle that they survive almost intact. And this is the sort of thing we used to imagine in the temples, of course. Now, that again is our triangular symbol of the island, the Trinacria. And then we'll quickly look at Selinunte. Selinunte, which was founded by the Greek settlers in 640, very, very close to the Carthaginians, which is why eventually it'll be destroyed totally by the Carthaginians. And then the city of Segesta, which is a wonderfully secretive place. It's kept all its secrets. It wasn't Greek, Probably Elamians lived there, those earlier tribes, and it's very close to the Carthaginian settlements. But both these cities have wonderful temples. I mean, unbelievably beautiful temples. And at Selinunte, which is right on the coast, you have here this temple structure. Ruined, though the ruins in front, the flowers, swing flowers, swinging up everywhere, the Mediterranean behind. I mean, it is an absolute magical place. And in fact, it's wonderful to go there because it is big enough to absorb everyone. In fact, there were a lot of people there when I took this photograph, but I've eliminated them all from the temple. It is absolutely fantastic. It's one of the great examples of the grandeur, of the strength, of the monumentality of Greek temples at their greatest. Sadly, as I said, it's an early work, 494, 480. Sadly, as I say, the city was absolutely flattened by the Carthaginians, and people still lived there on and off, we know from archaeologists, but really, then earthquakes came and went, and actually it was just a ruin right up for the centuries and centuries. And then really they've begun to do some work on it now. But Segesta inland is a miracle. When you go to Segesta, you'll see this little temple here. And it is unbelievable. Here you see it in the spring flowers. A little applause, please, my very good photograph, this one. There you see the temple of Segesta, which, I mean, it's mysterious. What is so extraordinary is it was never finished. It's been like that, unfinished, since about 400 BC. You can see from this photograph, but it actually never did have a roof. They never actually bothered, it got round to fluting the columns. The columns are still all rough. Why that happened, we have no idea. We don't even know hardly anything about the people who lived there, except that they must have been very clearly influenced by the Greeks. And so probably this was a Greek who built it. But anyway, this wonderful sort of fairy tale-like structure just sits there in the middle of nowhere, even today. And there you see it, the Temple of Segesta. Then, of course, this is really on every tourist poster, on every Come and Visit Sicily program. It's the Theatre of Taormina. Not because the theatre is particularly special, though it is very grand, but of course it has a backdrop that you can't beat, really. It has Mount Etna in the background. Now, this is not Greek. This is Roman. The Greeks build these sensitive, balanced, harmonious structures. They don't know about concrete. They can't build into space. Here, this big, solid, magnificent structure with, of course, basements below and goodness knows what else is rebuilt. There was a temple there, of course. There was a theatre, rather, there during Greek times. But this has been all redone by the Romans. And again, both civilizations, of course, appreciating. Etna never fails. Etna is an active volcano which is always smoking. It's always throwing up lava. It's always rumbling, it's always got snow on the top, and so it is absolutely the most wonderful place. And there you can see Mount Etna with the snow and the smoke. Of course, why is Mount Etna so terrifying? Why does it create destructions and earthquakes and rumble all the time? Because the Zeus has imprisoned Typhaeus or Typhon in Mount Etna. Typhon is this dreadful monster with 100 heads which are always screaming and shouting, and so that's why Mount Etna is as it is. Now, one of the big tourist attractions is to go up Mount Etna. To do so means you're going to wind up and up and up and up and up windy roads all through rather dreary towns and so on. When you get there, eventually you change into another bus, go further up and up and up and up and up, and eventually you get out in freezing cold weather, absolutely frigidly cold, and all you do is walk for hours and hours on black lava. It's the most dreadful experience imaginable. Don't do it. The Romans come, of course. The Romans inevitably came. There is Carthage, or there was Carthage, you see, very close. It's only 100 kilometers between the western tip of Sicily and Tunisia today. So they defeat the Carthaginians, and then Sicily becomes their first province, their first colony in their empire. and Rome governs it. Of course, initially, when the Roman armies sweep across Sicily to get the Carthaginians out, the Punic Wars, the wars between Rome and Carthage, are fought on Sicily, on Sicilia, Sicilian land. Obviously, Roman armies are not famous for being kindly to old ladies. So obviously, there's a lot of destruction, there's a lot of damage, there's a lot of vandalism. But eventually, when that peace returns, Sicily will have hundreds of years of peace. It will simply become the granary for Rome. It will become the breadbasket. And as it was written at the time, Sicily became the nurse at whose breast the people of Rome is fed. So for hundreds of years, Rome actually really didn't bother too much about Sicily. They didn't build a great deal. There are no great Roman amphitheatres or roads or whatever the Romans built. But it was left in tranquility. It was recognized for the prosperity that it had and for the grain that it produced. What is extraordinary, though, is there was discovered in the middle of nowhere in Sicily, discovered in 1929, a huge villa. A villa which, you know, even the wealthiest oligarch today would envy. It was an enormous villa, with everything larger than life. Bathhouses you can't believe the size of, great reception areas, huge dining areas, corridors leading into infinity. It was all there because it was in later centuries was discovered, it was covered by a sort of mudslide. And now these mosaics are being unearthed. They're doing a lot of restoration at the moment. The most famous series of mosaics, and there are hundreds of thousands of mosaics there. The most famous is called the Bikini Girls. This is the 3rd century AD. So they're what, about 1,800 years old. They're the girls in their bikinis. She's got dumbbells on. They're running a race. They're playing netball. That one's won a prize. This one looks as if she might win a prize. And that's the sort of the victor, the sort of judge there on the left. Quite amazing. I mean, quite amazing. It's a wonderful place. It's called the Villa del Casale. It's outside a town, which, as I say, is actually in the middle. It takes you ages to get there even now. It must have, whoever owned this villa must have been extremely rich, but on the other hand, must have spent days, weeks, years getting to this place from Rome. But anyway, he did. And it is a fascinating survival. But as I say, Rome doesn't need much. What happens, though, is that Rome uses Sicily as a granary, and then Rome divides, east and west. The Western Empire falls to the invading Germanic tribes, the Vandals, the Huns, the Goths, the Visigoths. So Rome falls in 465, finally Rome itself, the capital, falls in 465, and the Eastern Empire takes over. The Eastern Empire, which of course will last until 1452. Now, the famous legal man, the famous man that establishes the law, is Justinian, and it is he, during his reign, that a lot of the Western Empire will be recovered. The African coast, a bit of Spain, the whole of Italy, and of course, Sicily. So the Byzantines return to colonize Sicily, as did their counterparts during the Roman Empire. And they don't leave much of a mark. Sicily was Greek-speaking anyway. The Byzantines are also Greek-speaking, so that gives them an affinity. They administer the island very well. They establish the Christianity, although already there would have been Christian influences because the Vandals who've come before them, who sacked Rome, the Vandals were also Christians. So there would have been Christianity established during the Byzantines. But generally, they don't leave much of an impact. And eventually, as we know, the Byzantine Empire was always rife with dissension, always faction fighting faction, emperor being murdered, and so on. It goes on and on and on. So eventually, Sicily becomes ignored, and then the Arabs appear. The Arabs have swept, of course, from out of Arabia. And again, if they want to dominate the Mediterranean, they need to dominate Sicily. So by the 800s, the Arabs begin to infiltrate. They capture Palermo, and interestingly, Palermo, from the time the Arabs capture it, will become the capital. Prior to that, Syracuse. Syracuse is down there. This is this Arab map. Palermo is up there. And Palermo, from the Arabs onwards, right to the present day, is the capital of Sicily. Syracuse originally was the earlier capital, and at one stage, for a very brief moment, it was the capital of the Byzantine Empire. Now, if the Arabs will take about 150 years to capture or conquer Sicily, they do it slowly, progressively, and still today there's a huge Arab influence in various respects in Sicily, and a lot of the towns you can see there, Palmasala, which is the western city, is an Arab name. Palermo is an Arab name. And then anything beginning with Kalta, and there are lots and lots of towns beginning with Kalta, means a castle in Arabic. And they are enormously beneficial. Quite extraordinarily, when we think of now the intolerance of the Arab world to all other religions and races and so on, look at what's going on in Nigeria at the moment. The Arabs then were amazingly sophisticated, they were amazingly cultured, and they were amazingly tolerant. They allow the populace on Sicily, which would have been the Latin Christians, the Byzantine Christians, the Jews, always was a small Jewish community, they allow them all freedom of worship. They could live under their own laws, as long as they obviously acknowledged the overlordship of them. And of course, the taxation was discriminatory. But then they weren't slaughtered. They were allowed to continue. And this is the pattern that's going to be set now for hundreds of years. The Arabs also not only benefit Sicily, they benefit the West. See what they introduce here. All these aspects of our cuisine, which we think of as natural today, all came through Sicily via the Arabs into the West. The aubergine originally came from India. Jasmine oil, of course, came from China. The mulberry tree, of course, from China. The Arabs established the silk industry in Sicily, which was a big industry under the next successive rulers, the Normans. Oranges and lemons, the Romans knew about them, their references to them, but actually the cultivation of them was again introduced to Sicily by the Arabs. The very word orange comes from the Arabic naranj. Rice, of course, sugarcane, both from the east. Spinach comes from Persia. The watermelon, again, the Romans knew about the watermelon because it came from Egypt, but then again it's introduced as a cultivated product by the Arabs. They also seemingly, but the debate will rage for eternity, they seemingly introduced pasta, and and Marco Polo never did. I mean, if he did, it was 200 years after the Arabs. The Arabs definitely made some sort of pasta, we know that. And in addition, we definitely know that paper was introduced by the Arabs into the West. So they were amazingly influential. And they are very beneficial rulers. Why they could do all this, by the way, was that they were very astute, they were very mathematically minded, they were very great engineers in their time. They constructed water channels, irrigation channels, and so on, which again was a new trend. Now, however, and we're jumping, I'm afraid, but now we jump from the Arabs to the Normans. To the Hauteville. The Hauteville were a family, rather like the family of William the Conqueror, who went to England. This lot went south. And they arrive as the Normans were. The Normans, as you know, were Scandinavian. They settled in northern France, got bored with northern France. Oh, well, they didn't really, but they started moving out of northern France to various places. A lot of the Normans went and fought for the Byzantines. Here they were those who were down in the Italian peninsula. The event which precipitates their acquisition of Sicily is what is called the Great Schism. When in 1054, the Roman Church breaks with the Byzantine Church. I mean, one of the most cataclysmic events in Christian history, really, the most stupid event, really, but anyway, they break. And so now the Pope in Rome looks down his peninsula and says, he doesn't really like the Arabs, but they're quite, you know, sort of pleasant. They're not doing any terrible things. But he'd rather like a Christian. But what he's really worried about is that the Byzantines will return. They're now daggers drawn. What he doesn't want is the Byzantines to come back and conquer Sicily. So what he does is say to the Hauteville family, particularly to Roger Guiscard and his brother Roger the First, Roger Count Roger, he's called. He says to these two men, if you go and conquer Sicily, I'll make you the Duke of Sicily. which of course they do. I mean, it's a lovely offer they can't refuse. They take 30 years to do so. And they also introduce, not so much Giscard because he dies, Roger, his son, Roger the First, is the first of these amazing rulers. They follow in the tradition of the Arabs, but they rule a beneficent society. They are tolerant. They introduce multiculturalism. They are just the most extraordinarily beneficent rulers imaginable. Now, the great, great figure is Roger II. In Italian, Ruggiero II. Ruggiero II is really, without any shadow of argument, the greatest Sicilian that has ever lived or died. He was born in Palermo, he dies in Palermo. And he is an amazing man. And we'll discuss him for the rest of the first half. We have not much left now. Now, this is his mantle. His mantle is silk, of course. Silk from the factories now in Palermo, introduced by the Arabs. Silk which almost looks as if it was made yesterday, and it's actually 900 years old. And it is embroidered with amazing gold thread and hundreds and thousands of little pearls, which you can't see them in this larger view. It's the heads of their lions are capturing camels. Well, I mean, that obviously is the Normans conquering the Arabs, but it never happened like that. I mean, the Normans just seamlessly continue the tolerance of the Arabs. All races are given prominence. In fact, most of the bureaucracy of Norman Sicily was run by the Arabs. It becomes undoubtedly the richest country in the whole of Europe. The Kingdom of Sicily is the envy of the rest of Europe. It's so advanced. And through it comes culture brought in by the Arabs. And here, what is so extraordinary is we know all about this enormous mantle, because all around the border is an inscription. It tells us it was made for Roger II. It was made in the workshops of Palermo. The date is 1133 to 1134. It's all in Arabic. All this inscription there is actually in Arabic. For a Christian king, it's quite amazing. The tolerance is extraordinary, whereas today everything is just fragmented into such intolerance. And this again, I think, is even a better example. That on this side is a column in the Cathedral of Palermo. It's a column which has a typically Islamic sort of plaque with Arabic script from the Quran in a Christian cathedral. I mean, this would be a fatwa today if you did this, for goodness sake. I mean, it is just extraordinary. And there is a Norman Sicilian lady, we don't know her name, we know her tombstone there, and the tombstone is in four languages, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and Arabic. Those are the languages of the island. Those are the languages which Roger II spoke. And Roger II is, as I say, really one of the greatest figures of the Middle Ages, one of the greatest of all Sicilians. Now, here in this quite entrancingly beautiful town, this beautiful town called Cefalù, again, very good photographs, little chair, please. Taken last April, you can see this amazing cathedral that Roger builds. He builds this cathedral. Why, we don't know. Well, there are legends about it, but he obviously had an affinity. Why wouldn't he? It was such a beautiful place. And he builds this cathedral with sort of nestling into this huge headland. And the cathedral of Cefalù is begun by Roger II in 1131, unfinished at his death. So we are nearly 900 years ago. It is hardly changed. You recognize it. The entrance arches are later. Those funny little sort of cappy things are later. Otherwise, the facade is built as it was, remains as it was. And inside, it is one of the most spiritual, one of the most beautiful places of worship. Really, I think anyone could wish to see it. It's quite amazing. And there is this superb interior. He would know the stone. He'd recognize those capitals. He would know those mosaics. And the mosaic, and it only is just to that age. Well, he probably did intend to complete the rest of the building with mosaics, which he never lived to do. Nobody else does anything about it. That's why it just remains. It remains as it was. And look at the great figure of Christ. What is these big figures of Christ? They're Byzantine in influence. That is the Byzantine influence. Obviously, Byzantine mosaicist. It is Christ the all-powerful, Christ the ruler of us all, called Christ Pantocrator. And there he is, this enormous, powerful figure. But when you see it close up, he is this amazingly sympathetic, caring, kindly face. He's sort of, you want to sort of embrace it. And it has been written by many very great commentators that really it must be certainly one of, if not the most moving, the greatest image of the Christian faith. There he is with his Bible in two languages, Greek and Latin, with his hand showing the Trinity. And there the Bible reads, "I am the light of the world. He that followeth me will not walk in darkness." It is this quite superb, serene, magnificent, balanced, calm mosaic, of course, never changing in colour because it's all of glass. So it has this quite incredible effect. Rogers Cathedral in Cefalù. Cefalù, which is on the northern coast of Sicily. Now, an example of the incredible intellectual and cultural diversity of his court in Palermo is this man, Aladrisi, who actually dies in Sicily. Aladrisi came from the North African coast, and he publishes this book called the Tabula Rogeriana, which is the Book of Roger, and it's a book which, in fact, is part travelogue, part geographic thesis, part series of maps. And in that book, 1100s, he says, in the first page, he says, "The world is a sphere and the waters remain on it by their own sort of movement." That is saying the world is round. The Christian church was still maintaining it was flat in the year 1600, for goodness sake. And there you see, however, when it, in this manuscript, which there are a number of these, but the manuscript that from which this is taken is in Istanbul, actually, it is upside down. The Arab looked at the world upside down. That is Sicily upside down. This is Northern Europe here. So we're going to turn it round. So there is Sicily, the yellow arrow points to it. There is Italy, that's a very large Adriatic Sea. That is Arabia, of course. That's the African coastline. Rather wonky about England and so on, but nevertheless. it was such an important manuscript, such an important map, that it actually inspires Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama, for goodness sake. And this is all at Roger's court. There were huge numbers of the intellects from Spain, from the Middle East, from Alexandria, all coming through Roger's multicultural society. And there again, he lives in this palace. The Palace of the Lord. Now, of course, obviously this building has been rebuilt and so on through the centuries. That's now a 19th century building where the Parliament of Sicily meets. But there, the centre, is the palace where Roger lived. That is the Norman Palace there. And the Norman Palace is down there. Now, inside the palace, number 5 on the map, is the Roger's Chapel, the Palace Chapel, the Cappella Palatina, the Palatine Chapel. And the Palatine Chapel is one of the jewels of interior wonderment in the world. It is unbelievable, this incredible interior. It is all covered from top to toe in mosaics, and they are 900 years old. And I was there in April with a wonderful group of Australians. We had the most amazing tour. Amongst the group was this hard-bitten, world-weary, alcoholic journalist. She was a woman, and as I walked in, she happened to be next to me, and you know, she was always smoking and doing terrible things. And as we walked in, she actually said, "Oh, wow." And I thought, gosh, this really must be great if it affects you. And it is amazing. There again is the Christ Pantocrator. There again is the dome with, slightly out of focus, I'm sorry, but you'll see it better on the right there, with the four evangelists, all this glittering, glimmering, wonderful imagery, all done, of course, seemingly either by craftsmen from Byzantium, from Constantinople, or those that have taught these craftsmen. The Palatine Chapel, which is a miracle. It is one of the great places of Christian worship. It was Roger's Chapel. And the multiculturalism is so prevalent, because here all these mosaics with Christ, the angels, the four evangelists, the Bible, and so on. You look up to the ceiling, and what you see is a wooden ceiling, which again is a miracle that it survived, because it's 900 years old. It's Arabic. It, in fact, is the best example, the biggest example of Arab woodwork ever created. And it is still surviving today. I mean, how that's managed, it's cedar wood, by the way, so it actually obviously doesn't attract bugs and beetles, but nevertheless, it's survived. And the wooden ceiling, which is Islamic in style, and it is the greatest example of Islamic woodwork. Now, it's actually painted, but sadly, of course, the paintwork has faded through the centuries, and you can only see the paintwork if you look at it through binoculars or whatever. But the detail there is one of these little sections in the ceiling, and that they paint Roger. Now, normally, these are Arabs working on this. This is a place of worship, and normally a place of worship the Arabs never have representations of figures. There's Roger there with a crown that he's got from a Christmas cracker, and he's actually bearded. He's actually bearded, and do look at his beard. It looks as if he's just put all his mouth into the chocolate ice cream. It's all covered. And there is Roger as an Arab potentate sitting there. And there's the ceiling, obviously, in earlier representations. Now, again, there are lots of these early buildings. And this is a fascinating one because it's called San Cataldo, built by one of the ministers, or what were then called the emirs. By Roger, these leaders of his political fortunes. And Mario Bari dies, well, actually he's murdered before he decorates it, which is fascinating. Well, there's wonderful little domes there, which are so typically Middle Eastern. You can see their construction, because it was never covered with mosaics, because the founder died. And there you can see the typical Arab form, because these are Arab engineers, you see, building a Christian church, and there they are building on what are called squinches, a dome on squinches. Now, just next to this, this is in the middle of Palermo, next to this is this jumble. This is typically Sicilian. The centuries come by, people leave their various things, it all becomes a haphazard jumble, it remains frightfully dirty, nobody wants to clean it, it's all a bit chaotic, and it has these treasures hidden within it. The building we'll just see is off to the right. There's a Norman tower, a Byzantine dome, a Baroque facade, all jumbled and badly locked about. You go inside and see what you find there. This is the church called the Church of the Admiral. This is another of Roger's emirs. He was called George of Antioch. I mean, isn't it the most amazing piece of artistry, of colour, of beauty? These are all going back, as I say, 900 years. It's just incredible. Of course, a lot of this is redone. But anyway, what is fascinating is that the dome, which is not very good. I think you wouldn't give this 10 out of 10. These angels there are sort of doing the haka or something. It's most cute. What is interesting, and you may just make it out, there is round the base of the dome of this church, which is called the Church of the Admiral, there is round the base of this a hymn. George of Antioch, who is the patron founder of this church, is from the East. He's an Orthodox Christian. And it's a Byzantine hymn. Well, what's new about that? I mean, we sing hymns in church, except that the Byzantine hymn is all written in Arabic. And again, it's this incredible fusion of cultures, of traditions, of languages, of peoples in this harmonious society. And what are they producing? The most amazing things. And finally, in this, in the Church of the Admiral is a mosaic again, which of course is the 1100s, framed in a Baroque frame of the 1800s. There is the founder, George of Antioch, looking like a gold cockroach, really. And on the other side is Roger. On the other side is this amazing man. That spells out Roger the King. And there is Roger, slightly lied. He's got the beard on, being crowned by Christ. It's a Byzantine crown. This robe, which is the first time in history that a monarch is wearing the fleur-de-lis as a symbol of his kingship. He's got a wonderful sort of cummerbund. He's a bit portly. Getting like me, I'm afraid. And there is Roger, this amazing man. This man who didn't live very long, nobody did in those days, but a man who was tolerant, a man who was visionary, a man who was extremely cultured, multilingual, embracing all these peoples, all these cultures, whether they were Jewish or Byzantine or Arabic or Latin, in this amazing kingdom, a kingdom in the sun, the kingdom which was then the most powerful and the richest kingdom in Europe. It was Sicily, the kingdom of Sicily, and he dies and is buried in Palermo Cathedral, this simple, plain, sort of solid grandeur of his porphyry tomb. The column surrounding it might be a bit later, but there is Ruggero Due, the great, great monarch of Sicily. So we'll break up now and have a little, only 15 minutes, and I'll see you at 15:15. Thank you very much.